And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The resurgence of the urban core of Cincinnati and northern Kentucky is leading to the redevelopment of historic buildings and the construction of new ones. But not all design is created equally. There has been much criticism over the look of new apartment buildings on both sides of the Ohio River. So what makes for good and successful design in the 21st century? Joining Cincinnati Edition today are GBBN architects Marcy Kinney. She's the Director of Culture and Education. Welcome, Marcy.
Hi.
And Steve Kinnott. He's the Director of Community Development. Welcome, Steve.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having us.
513-419-7100 is the number to call if you'd like to ask an architect a question about design trends and what's going on in the construction field from the design perspective. 513-419-7100. You can also email your questions or comments to talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets there and try to get some of those into the show as well. So I want to start by talking about the urban renaissance that's taking place on both sides of the river in Cincinnati and northern Kentucky. What has this past decade or so meant to the architect field in terms of the impact that this urban redevelopment has had?
I'd say it goes back even longer than a decade. We have had a chance to rediscover our downtown, and we're not alone in that. These trends are happening across the country, which is a great place to be as an architect. But also, Cincinnati has had a unique opportunity to rediscover over the Rhine. And that area of the city that had been so underutilized, so little of that those buildings had been occupied for so long, that this opportunity to rediscover our downtown has really been a little bit different in Cincinnati than many other cities that are seeing those same trends.
And your thoughts on that, Marcy?
Yeah, I think Steve nailed it. The energy begets energy. So once we start this snowball rolling of investing in our urban core, then you start to see more and more take off from that. And that's what we've seen on the arts side for sure.
And your firm has worked on some very significant projects in the urban core. It's one of the reasons we've got you on today. We're going to talk about some of those on the back half of our interview. I'm curious, though, about the study of architecture. Has this boom in the downtown area created any new interest among younger people who might consider this a field for them?
Well, certainly, I don't think there's enough architects, so hopefully it has. We're starting to see more and more diversity come into the profession for sure. And we've seen a resurgence of people coming back to Cincinnati that have felt like they had to go and study abroad, that are coming back to Cincinnati because of the quality work we're doing here. And they look different, which is great. The diversity is amazing that we're seeing.
When redeveloping the downtowns on either side of the river, we're seeing sometimes new construction, and we're also seeing this really cool adaptive reuse work that's taking place in some of the historic structures. What's easier, or why is one more challenging than the other, or what's the pros and cons of both of those? Is it new construction, or is it taking an old building and turning it into something new?
I actually think that there's more challenge associated with the adaptive reuse. Those buildings that, you know, again, you're looking at this Italianate architecture. It was built for a whole different time and lifestyle, tenement buildings and things like that had commercial spaces. And finding a way to adapt those into current lifestyles is, I think, more challenging than something that is consistent. When you're dealing with a new building, you always know what you're working and what you're up against once you get out of the ground anyway. And OTR, we have some of that too, where we find lagering cellars and things like that. So sometimes even getting out of the ground is a challenge. But with new buildings, you know what you're up against. And existing buildings, you're always rediscovering those and trying to reposition it so that people have that kind of sense of their own lifestyle, what kind of choices they want to make, what they're looking for.
We also hear a lot about the need for sustainable projects and processes and greener living. What role does the effort to be greener in cities play in the design process?
It's absolutely fundamental. We've actually shifted our terminology to resiliency. It's no longer about sustaining, but it's about creating healthy environments for the people inside the buildings, but also so that we can be ready for any of the climate change or the weather pattern changes that we've been seeing. If anybody's driven down Columbia Parkway lately, that is the kind of stuff that we're trying to ensure that the buildings that we design are prepared for.
That was something I wanted to ask about, was how climate change and that conversation impacts the conversations in places like your workplace.
It absolutely. If I back up, Cincinnati is an interesting place. We have a plethora of resources at our advantage that we can take advantage of. We don't have a shortage of water or daylight. So to be energy conscious is absolutely fundamental, but to do it in a way where being inside the building is healthy is absolutely the most important thing we do.
So how do you, what data are you using to project the types of changes that you will have to make as an industry in your approach to architecture and design? What are you looking at? Whereas, you know, climatologists are feeding us all this information and saying this is the type of dangers that may be coming your way in this part of the world. What are you looking at?
Well, certainly from a standpoint of building systems and building materials, and that's relatively easy in a lot of ways to get your hands around, right? There's always new technology that is making buildings a little bit smarter, making systems that condition the buildings and make the buildings a little bit easier to maintain. That's something that you're always looking for in resiliency. I think there's a whole other facet of resiliency that has to do with not just the economic trends, but the demographic trends also. And something that we talk about a lot is, you know, you're looking at the trends that were set by the millennials who are moving into downtowns and urban areas, which is great. And you're looking at boomers, and those are the biggest segments of our population. When the millennials start in their family formation and they start moving to the suburbs, or they feel like they need to have their own plot of grass to mow, or they're looking for different schools, when you look at the boomers, they're coming down as two-person families, and inevitably there's a whole other exit strategy for them. How are our cities going to maintain the kind of vibrancy that we've gotten? So we're trying to design buildings that won't just lease up the first time, but will be resilient so that 5 years and 10 years away, they still are going to be good contributing buildings to the fabric that we have.
When you approach a project that involves a historic structure and you're trying to make that greener or, as you say, more resilient, what are some of the challenges that are specific to an historic building when you're trying to implement that strategy?
There's a lot of different facets to that, and some of that has to do with the historic context too. So we need to be very careful, especially when we're doing a lot of adaptive reuse that is geared towards historic tax credits and literal preservation of fabric. We need to be very careful about windows. We need to be very careful about exterior materials. The historic guidelines, the Secretary of the Interior guidelines, are very strict relative to what you can and can't do to change the appearance or even the historical context of the building. So you always have to figure out very creative ways to provide the kind of insulation, the kind of envelope that you want to have so that your systems can be efficient that are within them.
Are we seeing more recycled materials used in design around here?
Definitely. There's recycled content is a big part of it. Just being smarter with the materials that are originally specified, whether they have recycled content or not, just something that is going to last for a long time and doesn't need a lot of maintenance cost.
What about locally sourced materials? Is that important?
It is, and that's where we have an advantage in Cincinnati. We have so many materials that are right here within our arm's reach that we don't have to burden the system by shipping in materials from far.
What do people want in the urban core, and how do you respond to that from a design standpoint?
I guess you'd again have to look at the different demographic trends that are there. And everybody wants something different, and that's something that when we take that lens to approach a design problem, whether it's in the urban core or it's even in the first or second ring suburbs, we really try to understand the users who are going to be there, the people who will live there, the people who will make a choice, a decision to actually plant a flag and live in this neighborhood. We want them to be satisfied with not only the way the kitchen lays out, but what kind of neighborhood experience you have. I mean, we're trying to hold on to these residents, and it's not just about the attraction, it's about the retention, so that, again, our neighborhoods can stay vibrant.
How do you respond to an urban project that involves an old building that has some dangers in it that may have been used, some materials that may have been used when they were allowed, asbestos, lead, those types of things? How do you factor that into the design process?
We did a lot of discovery in the Union Terminal process, and we had done that renovation. And so working very closely with environmental assessors and people who could do the testing, not surprisingly, that building had a fair amount of asbestos in there. It had some lead paint in there. A lot of that work had already been removed over the course of the time in the museum's work in there and replacement of systems. But there was a lot of asbestos primarily that was caught up in the building envelope that had never been touched, and things like the glazing of the windows and things like that. So where we removed that, we had to go back in and encapsulate and then put back material that was going to be safer.
There seemed to be a period in cities, even around here, after the suburbs sort of took hold of retail and housing, that the cities would then try to implement some of that suburban design into their own communities. You'd see more strip malls coming into urban areas, the removal of some historic neighborhoods to make way for that. And now, and this is just purely anecdotal from just driving around, it looks like a lot of suburban development is trying to mimic the design of downtown areas. There's even a newer Walmart out in Florence that looks like it has three levels, even though it doesn't. It's just to give that appearance. Are you finding that as a trend in the industry, that suburban development is trying more to mimic the urban style?
I think that's very true. I think that's accurate. They're trying to create an experience, right? And so what you're trying to do is hold on to people for a longer period of time, whether that has to do with an afternoon or it has to do with years that they will continue to rent. If you look at communities, neighborhoods like Blue Ash, they've actually done a great job of pulling in, creating an experience around the Summit Park area that has live, work, play opportunities. It has a great park. It has a great place for people to come together and celebrate in the same way that Washington Park or Smale Park does for downtown.
We're going to talk about housing units and the styles that people are after in downtown areas, whether people really want tiny homes or not, and what's going to happen with the aging boomer population, some of the creative approaches to create thriving retail, our discussion on current trends and modern architecture. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Let's pick up our conversation about current trends in modern architecture in Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky. We're joined today by GBBN Architects Marcy Kenny. She's the Director of Culture and Education there. And Steve Kennett, he's the Director of Community Development. Join our conversation at 513-419-7100. Email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets there. I want to talk about housing trends in the urban core and how you approach them from the design viewpoint. Is this tiny home thing real? Is this something that people are looking for? And is there a role that architecture firms play in that?
I think there is. I think people are finding opportunities to do more with less. Having recently downsized myself, we moved downtown. We have an apartment downtown. I didn't need to take care of a lawn. I didn't need to take care of a house. And that has simplified my life. I think that that is a trend that people are continuing to appreciate. I think the question is going to be, again, over time, how many 650 square foot or 750 square foot apartments will be sustained or sustainable when millennials have families and when people start to need just a little bit more elbow room.
Yeah, what happens then? I happen to live in one of those units, about 700 square feet, a studio. First time I've ever lived in a place like that. You see a one-room situation, think, how could I ever do it? And then you do it, and you're like, this is great. How would I ever live any other way? And that's kind of what would force the answer to that question is, well, what happens if I have a family or something? This won't work. So what happens to those spaces then? Are they calling up the architects again and we're going to redevelop this building again?
I think that's the question of resiliency that we're always talking about, too. And so if you take an example of a tenement building that was built in over the Rhine in the late 1800s, where people had literally shared restrooms and had six or eight people living in a one or two room apartment, that's a whole different aspect of lifestyle that people aren't going to go back to. But now when we talk about the family formation and the need to have just a little bit more space, how do the buildings that we design now, how will they remain flexible over time so that units or walls can adjust and can be amended? It's something that you can do in Over the Rhine, but you're doing it once every six generations. I think the question now in a lot of the buildings that you're seeing in the urban area, are they going to be adaptable and flexible over time? And that's a question we always struggle with.
Well, you often hear in this conversation about who's driving the renaissance of the urban core, that it's millennials and empty nesters, with that Gen X generation in between, sort of still doing the family thing.
We just
thing,
don't have the numbers. Right.
Exactly. So there's younger people without children or just newlyweds sort of situation, maybe with babies. And then there's older people who are selling their big suburban homes and coming back downtown and living in smaller spaces to take in that urban lifestyle. Is there going to be a generation behind the millennials that will naturally become the next target demo for this type of housing that's down here?
There is, but not unlike the Gen X, our generation, the Generation X, we don't have the same numbers that the boomers nor the millennials do. And so that cycle of a demographic trend in the same time that the economic trends are there, there's going to be some battles there to make sure that we can hold on to that density. And density is really good when you're trying to bring people together for those kinds of shared experiences.
When we talk about the empty nesters, we're referencing them as people who are coming down to still take in the lifestyle. But what about senior housing, where people might require some type of assistance or a different type of lifestyle as they've gotten to maybe an even higher age in their life? Is there a certain type of design approach downtown to that type of project?
I think that has more to do with the positioning of an individual project. There's all kinds of great partners that do senior living and do great senior programming. I can't think of any that are specifically to the downtown area, but there's a lot in the first and second ring suburbs that do that, and they bring those kind of services. The external programming comes there, and they offer fitness classes, and they offer opportunities for people to convene together. I think a lot of those, in a good way, ghettos happen kind of naturally. You know, you have friends who are the same age or in the same age range, and you wind up wanting to live near each other. And sometimes it happens to be inside the same building, and sometimes it just happens to be on the same street.
I was going to say the common thread between all of these is experience and what is a good experience. And I think what we're finding in the urban core in this renaissance in Cincinnati is that we're really trying to uniquely define what it is. And it's building off of the assets that we have, the parks, the river, the outdoor spaces that you can go to. Earlier, you talked about the suburbs. And I think that if you're fair, when you go through the city, you see a lot of people reacting to things that are already successful. And I think as architects, that's where we try to stay ahead of the curve and anticipate what authentically wants to happen rather than copy something that's happened somewhere else.
You heard me reference that I live in one of those studio apartments that have popped up in the urban core. And I love it. Of course, I love it. But there are occasions where I'm like, I just don't have enough storage. I don't have enough closet space. I do have a washer and dryer unit in there, which is very nice. But what are some of the trends that you're seeing in the design of these units to, I guess, maximize some of the storage space and the closet space and some of these tinier units?
We're doing a lot of built-ins. We're doing a lot of cabinetry that kind of fits itself into walls and storage areas. The best amenity, though, to being downtown is downtown. And if that's the kind of experience you want, and it's also, you know, that we talked about the number of people who kind of co-locate or cohabitate, but what people are really looking for is diversity. And they're looking for diversity of experiences. They're also looking for diversity of neighbors. And having people who you interact with on a daily basis who do something different for a living, or they're at a different place in their age and their lifestyle. My daughter, who is 12, has had a wonderful time getting to know some of our neighbors who are seniors, and she goes to occasionally, you know, play board games with them and things like that. And it's been a great opportunity for her to get exposed to just people with different interests and people who are at a different place in their lives.
513-419-7100 is the number to call to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones. We have Ellen on the line. Hi, Ellen. What's your question or comment?
My question is, given our concern about revitalizing the city, what are the guests considering about the 40,000 units of affordable housing that we are missing as a city? Is displacement of affordable housing going to continue? And what are the consequences of that for the whole city?
Ellen, thanks for the call. We'll hang up and let our guest take a shot at that one. So there was a report recently that suggested that the Cincinnati region is short 40,000 affordable units. And Ellen wants to know whether there is an architectural role in alleviating that problem.
There absolutely is. And one of the things that we're very involved in is a variety of housing projects that speak to affordability and can offer the different rungs of the housing ladder, whether that's a place that you are in your life and looking for a tiny home or tiny apartment and being able to then grow into the space that you would need, and also the affordability factor. So we're working on a project right now in Over the Rhine that will eventually bring on 200 affordable housing units, one of the largest affordable housing projects that's been taken on in the city. And we're doing that in partnership with a couple of developers, including 3CDC, who is trying to very carefully renovate existing building stock, as well as do some infill projects that don't change the dynamic of downtown, or they're not overly dense for the Over the Rhine neighborhood, but they feel authentic to Over the Rhine.
We got an email from Linda. She says she renovated a multi-use building in Over the Rhine into a single residence. She added solar, geothermal, and electrical charging stations. So there's an example of somebody trying to improve the resilience of an historic building. We also got an email from Jeff. He says that a lot of Hyde Park older houses are being torn down and replaced with buildings that do not fit in with the neighborhood, instead of updating existing houses with new technology and materials. And he would like your thoughts on that process.
Well, the teardowns in Hyde Park obviously it's very controversial. I think what we're seeing, though, is not unlike the trend that you just spoke about. People really don't want a 2,800 or a 3,400 square foot house. It is an awful lot of real estate to take care of. It's a lot of gutters to clean out. It's a lot of lawns to be mowed. So I can understand that from both impression. I hate to see some of this great fabric be lost. At the same time, you know, people aren't having 4 and 5 children very often anymore, and people don't need that kind of space. And there's a question of how resilient those buildings can be. I think it's great that your caller had renovated an Over the Rhine building. Most of those buildings are kind of too large for a single family home, and that's one of the things that's set. But it's too small maybe for an office. So that inflexibility over the Rhine fabric is something that we're always trying to navigate.
We also got an email from Mark, and he's asking a question that I have on my list of questions for you as well, but we'll phrase it as Mark emailed us. He says he hates seeing all these buildings that look the same. Northside looks the same as Clifton, looks the same as ... And I guess the point is, a lot of this new urban redevelopment that involves new construction, particularly the apartment projects, is that they look very similar, whether you're in the new buildings in Covington, the new buildings in Newport, and certainly the new buildings all over Cincinnati, is that they have this same sort of blocky, boxy look, maybe with retail or parking on the ground floor and then the residences above. And people are just wondering, why do they all look the same? So first, do they all look the same from the eye of an architect? And two, if they do, why is that?
I think your caller's absolutely right. They are pretty formulaic. And what happens with building codes, what happens with economy, it kind of drives a lot of that. There's a podium model that allows you to do commercial or parking in the first floor, and then 3 or 4 stories of wood construction above. And that's usually the most economic model that is there. As an architect, they probably don't look all as much the same to me. But I do think that the projects, the infill sites that we're working with in Over the Rhine, are intended to fit into the context in a little bit different manner. We're working on a project right now with a developer in College Hill, and we spent a lot of time really understanding not only the people who would potentially move into that neighborhood, but the long-term residents of College Hill, and doing an analysis and understanding the College Hill fabric that is there. So while our building is 4 stories, it has a podium, it fits into that business district in a little bit different way and in a better way than a lot of the work that we've seen in other locations.
And when I hear criticism about these new apartment projects and their design, and I guess I find that the attachment of some of that criticism is to the out-of-character nature of those projects, as you're describing, as you try to avoid in College Hill. It's that, you know, this building is going to be surrounded by Victorian-era architecture, and this is going to just completely stick out. But then I think about Victorian architecture. When you drive around any of our historic neighborhoods, I think, well, these buildings all kind of look the same, too. So, I mean, is there just something more appealing to people visually from that period's architecture compared to what's happening now? Is there a difference in the quality of the materials that were used? Because to me, Victorian architecture, you know, they all kind of look the same as well.
Right. I think it's a question of understanding what's of the time. And while I do believe architecture, good architecture is in dialogue with its context. It doesn't mean it sticks out as an alien spaceship landing in the middle of it, but it has to be respectful in a way and have a conversation, so to speak, so that over time, that will become a growth. Simply replicating is not good.
One area that has struggled in the revitalization of the urban core on both sides of the river is retail. I mean, we're even seeing in downtown Cincinnati, we've lost Macy's, we've lost the Tiffany. So a lot of our landmark retail establishments aren't working. A lot of the newer ones aren't necessarily taking off. Are there design approaches that can help foster more success in the retail industry in the local downtown business districts?
I think retail overall has changed dramatically in the last 20 years. And whether that's the advent of the internet and people being able to shop online, or it just has more to do with the just-in-time delivery of how much inventory a company can afford to keep in stock. I think both of those are reasons that retail has become a smaller and more intimate experience. It's been very much geared towards the individuals who walk in the door to that shop. And if you go to some of the successful shops in Over the Rhine, you know, they really do a great job. And whether you're a regular or whether it's just a unique experience that you've never been in the city before, they do a great job of catering to that. And I think when you're looking at department store models, something like Macy's used to be downtown, there's still a place for that. But it happens, those buy-in bulk areas are more the suburbs, right?
Let's talk about some of the projects that your firm has worked on. They are very significant in the redevelopment of downtown Cincinnati. GBBN is involved in the music venue that is set to come to the Banks in Cincinnati. Talk about the design component of that.
That's a fascinating project in that, who is the audience? You know, who lives at the Banks? Who lives in downtown Cincinnati? Who frequents Smale Park? And so that project was all about creating an experience for people to come from the city to the river and from the city, or from the river back up into the city. And so it's much about being in and around the project as it is being in it. So the mark of success for that project is actually not just the selfies that are taken in front of the form of that building, but the quality of the environment around it. And that's measured in the success of the restaurants, how many more people come to frequent the area.
You also worked on Ensemble Theater and their expansion project and the Cincinnati Shakespeare Company's project as well. Tell us a little bit about that.
Great examples of two very, at one level, yes, they're both theaters and they're both professional theaters. And we are so fortunate in Cincinnati to have this level of cultural institutions that we can rely on and feed the dialogue of what good art is on stage. I've always found it really a unique opportunity that at the same time we had two different project teams in our office working on the Ensemble Theater, who is all about presenting new work, brand new relevant work that is being done in an adaptive reuse of a theater building for the Ensemble Theater. And then Cincinnati Shakespeare, who is doing Shakespeare and the Classics, is doing a brand new building on the corner of 12th and Elm in one of the most historic neighborhoods in the country.
I got to blow through these last two because we were just about out of time, and you worked on Union Terminal's renovation, huge project. What is it like to approach a project that involves something so well-known and loved by so many?
That was such a joy to be able to work on for us. It's a great project. It's a great building to be involved with. It's kind of a pinch-yourself project for an architect in Cincinnati. What I'm probably most proud of is that we've given them an opportunity not only to preserve the building as an artifact, but to be able to reinvent it for the next generation of learners and patrons.
And a huge project coming up, Court and Walnut Streets, mixed-use development, new Kroger.
successful retail, right? So 50,000 square feet of an urban grocer, it's about time we got there. But the opportunity to bring in as a transit-oriented development with 500 parking spaces and 130 apartment units, that's going to be a game changer, I think, for downtown. And it really does start to shift the gravity into an area of over the Rhine that can't be as dense as downtown and giving up a surface parking lot that has been there for a generation.
Last question. Blink, the wildly successful light show from a couple years ago, is coming back to downtown Cincinnati, expanding into Covington this time. How does the region's historic architecture lend itself to this type of display?
Oh, absolutely. Blink is an amazing, phenomenal experience. Architecture becomes the anchor for those experiences and those memories. It provides a context to the selfies that becomes something that someone will show someone years and years later.
Our thanks to GBBN architects Marcy Kinney and Steve Kennett for joining us. Appreciate the chat, guys.
Thanks for the opportunity.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. I'm Michael Monks. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org.